Sea Realm Vault Podcast, episode number 425, Sunday, May 8th, 2022.
The light of consciousness shines on everyone, but not everyone gains access to the vault.
Hey everybody, here is a conversation that I recorded just recently with Jim, your ad attacker, host of the Attack Ads podcast. So, you are listening to the Sea Realm Vault podcast. Actually, if you are actually listening right now, you're on YouTube. But this file will be unlisted, so you can catch it live. But if you don't catch it live, you have to be a Sea Realm Vault subscriber. And I'm talking with Jim, your ad attacker. And Jim, you had a response to my most recent Sea Realm, I don't know if it was the main Sea Realm podcast or a Sea Realm Vault podcast, but talking about the science and environmentalism. So I won't try to summarize or, you know, your arguments or take your thunder. So why don't I hand it over to you and you can tell me what you were thinking.
Well, I'm not sure I have a lot of thunder here, but yeah, I was on the vault and you were talking, I believe, to Michael C. Varhola.
Okay.
And you were talking about the possibility for life in other planets.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And of course, he was going with the statistics. Statistically, yeah, it's probably something that should happen. But as you pointed out, we have an example set of one.
Yeah.
Because if the distance,
we don't have any basis for saying how likely abiogenesis is, how likely life springing from non-living ingredients under the right conditions. Maybe it happens once in a gazillion times. Maybe it happens once in three. We just don't know. And until you have that variable, you can't make the statistical argument. You just don't have the information needed to make it.
Right. You can have the Drake equation on the blackboard all you want, but until you know all the variables, you can't even theorize about the likelihood. And we don't even have all the variables.
And we don't have any of the variables. I mean, what we have is a rough count of the number of stars in our galaxy and a rough estimate of the number of galaxies in the observable universe. But we don't know how much more of the universe there is beyond the observable universe. But for the purposes of interacting with non-human life from outside of our solar system, there's just a handful of galaxies that we could ever conceivably visit, given the, you know, rapid expansion of the universe. So there's a group of galaxies that we call the local group, and we are gravitationally, you know, bound to one another. So we are going to be close to one another pretty much forever. In fact, the Milky Way and the Andromeda Galaxy are in the process of merging. I mean, they're still pretty far apart right now, but by the time our sun enlarges to engulf the Earth, the Milky Way and the Andromeda Galaxy will be interpenetrating one another in a pretty serious way.
Right. And it will probably be a contact-free or contact-light collision given the space between the stars.
Right. In all likelihood, no stars will collide when the two galaxies collide.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, you just made a good point. It's like you have to have a data set of something other than one in order to calculate anything. And, well, we can't go out there and look at the planets because they are, I believe the technical term is a fuck ton away.
Yeah, far from here.
They already, it is a galaxy far, far away. And it's not even a long time ago. It's now. So,
except when you're looking at something far, far away, you're seeing it a long time ago.
You are time traveling through photonic space, indeed. The speed of light, you bastard. That's right. And I did like the fact that you brought up the Miller experiment, and it just kind of tickled a brain that the Miller experiment was where they loaded the ammonia and the methane and the water and the salts, and they zapped it with electricity and back in, what, 1952, I think it was?
Yep.
Did you know it's still there?
I did not. I know that the experiment has been reformulated and retried many times since then. I didn't know that the original Miller experiment equipment was still in place with its original contents.
Not the original equipment. The original contents were labeled and put in a shelf in a lab where Miller taught until his retirement. Uh-huh. And then somebody else took over and nobody bothered to clean out the cupboard. And so they did actually re-examine the Miller stuff, what, 50 years later, over 50 years later. And there have been changes. I don't remember exactly the nature of the changes, but I just thought that was cool. You know, because that's the one thing Miller didn't add was a significant stretch of time. Right. You know, you have to let the wine and the beer ferment.
Yeah, and it could be that... You know, what did they give it? A few days? It might take 100,000 years. It might take 100 million.
Exactly. Exactly. And it's in a cupboard. It's not under the sun, which is a nice thermal energy source and radio, you know, all kinds of energy coming down from that for free. So, yeah. I mean, if they had known that it was going to be in that cupboard, they might have put it on a shelf in a window.
Yeah. Yeah. As it is, if it's in the dark, then it's essentially a closed system.
Exactly.
That doesn't replicate the early Earth because, you know, we've had constant sources of energy from mostly from the sun, but also from geologic process.
That's right. We'll just put this in the entropy cupboard.
So what would totally, you know, upset the table, just throw it over the table and upset the board, would be if we discovered life on one of the moons of Jupiter or Saturn. Mm-hmm. And it had absolutely no genetic relationship whatsoever to anything on Earth. If it had happened twice in our one solar system, then we would have very strong reason to believe that life is quite common throughout, you know, our galaxy and presumably throughout the universe in general.
Yes, and if we discovered that that particular life had some relation to our life, then we have to start looking at the skies with a little more suspicion. The panspermia. Yeah.
Yes and no. I mean, asteroids hit our planet and stuff is projected off into space. I mean, it's entirely possible that life that evolved here, we might find it elsewhere in our solar system, even if we didn't take it there ourselves. It's possible.
Sure. I mean, especially if you consider the collision that we had that formed our moon and all of those rocks, you know, formed the moon. Well, okay, something else could have broken off from another broken project from maybe Jupiter's, was it the Lagrange asteroid belts? Absolutely could have hit Ganymede and Earth. You know,
yes.
Done the seeding right there. But, you know, but if you go to a place that's really distant and it's like, oh, wait a minute, this is DNA. Crap.
But we're talking about, you know, the Fermi paradox and the Drake equation and all that good stuff here. But I thought that what you had mentioned in the email was talking about people not really being able to understand each other very well when talking about the issue of climate change.
Yes. Yes. Your talk about, you know, exoplanets and everything somehow segued into climate change, where very few people, they get together and they talk about the importance of climate change or the importance of ignoring climate change, depending on which party you happen to be at the time. And nobody sits there and goes, okay, well, what is climate change? And I decided, it's like, okay, I asked myself, what is climate change? So I went down to the bookstore, and this was probably 10 or 15 years ago. It's like, okay, let's see what I can get from the library and the bookstore. And I just started reading books about climate change. And, you know, some of them were very interesting. In fact, I read two or even three books titled Greenhouse. So people aren't even trying very hard to name their books. It's like, wow, Greenhouse, a book on climate change. I think I'll write one too. Thanks.
To be fair, lots of authors do not get to pick the titles of their books. That's the public
yes.
doing.
Absolutely. But what struck me was that when reading three books called Greenhouse, nobody bothered to tell me what it was. Nobody bothered to tell me the scientific rationale for worrying about the accumulation of carbon dioxide. I think it was actually a lecture from some dude who went through the entire set of discoveries that led us to worry about this stuff. And I finally found a few books that actually followed that path as well. So that's really shocking when people can have long, involved conversations and shouting matches without knowing the mechanism that they should be worried about.
You mentioned something about people from different lifestyles, different worldviews, not being able to understand each other. And there was a phrase she used a couple times, which I really liked. It was turnkey, live life. So if you would unpack what you were talking about there.
Okay. In a nutshell, I've met, let's break them down into two camps because, you know, we each have a right and a left arm, hopefully. So that just seems to be the way we separate the life. You know, okay. There are people who are greatly concerned with climate change to the point where they change their lifestyles. They give up some of the things that they feel are contributing too much to the carbon accumulation, and they do other things to maybe what they call education, which I would never call education, another story. And then there are the other side of people who is like, they enjoy the life they're leading. They like driving their F-150s and Z-10s and all that. They like the turbocharged Rams and all that other stuff. They see no reason for them to give that up. And they don't like it when people are telling them that maybe they're driving too much truck to pick up a quart of milk or whatever it is they're doing. So the turnkey live life is, don't worry, you know, turnkey, drive, live. Whereas the other people are like, worry about every aspect of what I'm doing and how it affects the climate. I'm not saying it's bad to worry about that stuff, but when you put it in big perspective, you find flaws with both approaches, in my opinion.
So this, we don't need to spend a lot of time on this, but just one thing that irks me, you know, along those lines, is when somebody who owns multiple mansions, a private yacht, a private jet, and, you know, flies around the world, you know, wringing their hands with other fabulously wealthy people about how everybody else needs to downsize, you know, for the sake of the climate, and how the guy driving the F-150 is really, you know, horrible for doing so. But the person who flew to that conference on their private jet is a saint. That just sticks in my craw.
I would have to agree. Yeah, it has bad optics. I have a nice little phrase. I mean, that's the ultimate leather-clad vegetarian. It's like, look at me, I'm doing this. I'm doing it all for the good of the people. And even if they go as far as to tell their investment portfolio manager to start looking for carbon offsets, it's like, well, there is a market for carbon offsets. And if you look at them closely, some of them are beneficial and will cancel, mitigate, neutralize, pick your euphemism, make someone pretend is the real thing, that they're not flying and then renting a Ferrari to to drive around the twisty all roads of Italy or whatever, wherever it is. Yes, absolutely. The flip side of that is the very sanctimonious person who lives in a cave and burns no fossil fuels whatsoever. I don't know that I can really tolerate the presence of either person without suppressing the eye roll.
Yeah, well, you're not going to run into the hermit in the cave unless you go into the cave yourself.
Yes.
Unless, of course, they happen to be on Twitter, which a lot of them are.
Yes, yep. Well, they say they're in a cave on Twitter, but you can be anywhere on Twitter.
That's true. So I just want to acknowledge, can you see the chat? We have a chat.
Yeah, I have one. There's one entry from me. It doesn't say it's from me. It just says, hey, all. Can you see the chat?
Yeah, but I see a lot more. I see.
Oh.
We Create my Story says storms are rumbling here in the Sunshine State.
Oh, here we go. I have to. I had to click it. I had it on private chat. I'm sorry. I have it on comments now. Okay.
And Jake says, look forward to this. Hello, Jim. We Create Our Story invokes Jordan Peterson. Jordan Peterson just posted about our inability to overcome deceit and betrayal. Cynicism, bitterness, viciousness, a resentfulness, then act out in the world. Let's see. You're identified A, the prob.
It looks like they have a limit to the number of letters you can put into your comment.
I see.
I think he kept going.
Yes. Jordan Peterson just posted about our inability to handle deceit and betrayal and how that results in bitterness, viciousness, resentfulness, and cynicism. Jim, have you considered the pipeline as an attempt to address your ad tracking concerns? Or any of the sub $10 micro SD holding AA or AAA powered MP3 players one can get on eBay?
Oh, the Pine Phone, not Pipeline.
Oh, right. Pine Phone. I don't know what the Pine Phone is.
I don't either. Well, I can say.
I totally saw that as Pipeline.
Yeah, the only reason I was staring at it because it's like, what is a Pine Phone? I mean, I'm just.
Well, let me read that again properly then.
Okay.
Jim, have you considered the Pine Phone as an attempt to address your ad tracking concerns? Just go with that.
I have not heard of the Pine Phone. The only thing I can think of is Get Smart, where he had the shoe phone. And I can imagine putting a pine cone against my head to answer it is just going to make me go, ow.
So the second part, or any of the sub $10 micro SD holding AA or AAA powered MP3 players one can get on eBay. So a cheap MP3 player, I'm not sure how that gets around the tracking problem.
Oh, well, Jake, you can throw in a comment if this is true. You probably heard one of my episodes when I was complaining about things that I had just bought and things that I had just bought. And I was sharing my tribulations with my various devices. And Jake, I have found a player. I love it. And it's actually a rebatteried old player that the Fruities put out many years ago. And it works great. As far as the phone, I haven't looked at the Pine Phone. I know I absolutely hate my phone, but that's giving me the opportunity to actually research if I can find where those ad references are coming from. So the phone is in another room. It's not listening. Anyway.
So I'm looking at the page for the Pine Phone. It's a Linux phone. An open source smartphone supported by all major Linux phone projects. Perhaps you're in a line of work where security is a must, or a hardcore Linux enthusiast, or perhaps you've just got enough of Android and iOS and you're ready for something else. The Pine Phone may be the next phone for you. Powered by the same quad-core ARM Cortex A53 64-bit SoC used in the popular Pine A64 single-board computer, the Pine Phone runs mainline Linux as well as anything else you'll get it to run. The purpose of the Pine Phone isn't only to deliver a functioning Linux phone to end users, but also to actively create a market for such a device, as well as to support existing and well-established Linux on phone projects. All major Linux phone-oriented projects, as well as other FOSS OS, are represented on the Pine Phone, and developers work together on our platform to bring support to this community-driven device. All right. So it's a Linux phone.
Okay. And I also see with a new comment from Jake, it has hardware switches to turn off the radio, camera, and mic. That's pretty damn cool, I have to say. I am intrigued.
Okay. Now, I just need to chime in on the topic of, are our phones listening to us? The podcast Reply All did a deep dive into this. It was... At the time, the question was, is Facebook listening to our conversations through our phones? And they did a lot of research and came to the conclusion that that would be a very inefficient way to spy on us, that there are much more effective and much less bandwidth intensive ways to figure out who we've been associating with, what we're interested in, and what we're likely to do next. And that, you know, constantly listening to conversations via the phone is just not necessary.
While I agree with that, sadly, there is evidence that the phones are listening. Facebook, probably not. Facebook probably just buys the information from whoever is listening. And the evidence to support this, getting back to your original abiogenesis evidence, etc., is from Shoshana Zuboff in her book, The Age of Surveillance Capitalism, where there were people who were hired in kind of the Mechanical Turk gig economy. They were hired to listen to short sound files and transcribe and compare that to the AI interpretation. So, you talk and the computer types. They were there to compare the sound file to what the computer came up with and correct if necessary. And they leaked some of these files where people are like giving addresses and talking to people. And it's obvious they weren't talking on phones. Or we're talking on the phone to someone else. It's obvious that they were having conversations outside of the phone. There's also a little bit called edge computing. Yes, if the phone were listening and transmitting this data to central base, wherever that is, yes, it would be a high bandwidth cost. However, if you have a computer within the phone that can do voice to text, you have a computer in the phone that can do voice to text and simply text through update transfers, update data transfers. So it's a very low bandwidth when you consider that.
Yeah, my new phone, which is not so new anymore and doesn't look the least bit new because I dropped it recently, so now it has a broken screen. But, it's a Pixel 6. It's quite good at voice to text.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the one. I heard that Reply All, and I was shocked that they didn't address edge computing. But then I remembered, oh, wait, this is this show, which is an okay show. And I enjoy the few episodes I hear, but those guys are a little too focused in their focus.
Yeah. Well, it's NPR.
And it is.
To be fair, the episode that I'm talking about, yeah, they did specify is Facebook listening, not is Google or Apple listening.
Yes. And I do remember another aspect of that show. Everyone they talked to said, oh, yeah.
And they were, it is, and I'm not altering my behavior one whit.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, you can explain how it isn't, but I know it is. And yeah. I had an incident, I don't know if you heard that episode, that was so mind-bogglingly random that, oh my God, this is probably happening. So that's anecdata, I understand, but it was, I think it was in the episode called Sweat the Petty Stuff.
Right.
Anyway,
back to climate change.
Yes, climate change. Much better.
Yeah. Climate change and what I would say scientism. Mm-hmm. Scientism is, there's a number of definitions, but the one that I'm using here is people basically just treating science as a religion, not really understanding science, not understanding how science works, how scientific consensus is reached, just imagining that science is a body of undisputable facts laid down by this magical process called science. And I find a lot of scientism, a lot of very like flat-footed scientism in environmental circles.
Yeah.
The phrase, the science is settled, it just speaks volumes about how the people who circulate this phrase don't understand how science works, probably don't understand the difference between deductive and inductive reasoning. And inductive reasoning, no matter how much evidence that you have to support your hypothesis, in the future, any piece of refuting evidence can potentially come along to force you to re-examine your hypothesis or any number of auxiliary hypotheses that you pair with it to generate predictions. And if you think the science is settled, that there's no possibility that future information can upset the apple cart, then you simply do not understand how science works.
And to add to that, I would also say that if you say the science is settled and you haven't read every single piece of scientific literature on that topic, you are ignoring something that may unsettle the science.
I would guess that 99.999% of people who say the science has settled have never read a single scientific paper ever.
Exactly. Or if they have read it, how much have they understood?
Right.
I mean, I have tried reading scientific papers and I got my BA. I know how to read. But my God, scientific papers and masters and theses, there is a specialty to the verbiage and the format and the protocols that is mind-blowing to somebody who merely got a degree in reading.
Right. Well, as with most professions, a lot of the complexity and jargon is just meant to constrain the number of people that really can access it and participate in the discussion, thus making your, $100,000 education worth the money.
I would say, though, that would... There are professions that do that, that deliberately obfuscate the topic through jargon. And I would say economics is definitely one of them. Oh, yeah. The ones that I have more warm feelings toward, more warm fuzzies, are the ones that use this jargon very specifically to erase any ambiguity. So, you know, it was economics that Thomas Piketty referred to when he referred to scientificity. That is deliberately obfuscational. Physics, climate change physics especially, that kind of stuff. Yeah, you have to repeat things a lot. You don't use a lot of pronouns because pronouns can be applied to multiple elements of the sentence. So you see a lot of repetition. And it's sleepy time for anybody who's not used to reading that stuff.
Right. And what's more, a scientific paper on climate change isn't saying climate change, yes or no. Yes. You know, conclusion, yes. They're very, very specific about
yes.
extremely narrow fields of interest. You know, like the rate of snowfall accumulation on a particular glacier in Antarctica from 20,000 BC to 17,000 BC. You know, very, very specific stuff. And to get to the big picture, climate change, yay or nay, that's got to be a synthesis of thousands and thousands of different scientific, you know, papers and reports and whatnot.
Exactly. And in fact, the first, I mean, you could call it the very first experiment that revealed we may have a problem, Houston, we may have a problem with carbon dioxide, was John Tyndall's experiment in 1849. If I get the dates wrong, I apologize because I'm old. John Tyndall was kind of intrigued by an experimental paper that somebody says, like, we humans on this planet, I believe his name was Fourier, do not know how much energy comes out of the sun. If we need to measure that, we first need to measure the heat retention and later release properties of all of the major elements that we have here on this planet. So water, various types of rock, plants, and of course, John Tyndall, who was a mountaineer and who was really interested in gases. He said, I'll do gases. I'll do the atmosphere. So he set up a scientific apparatus. It had a little gas flame in the center. It had two pipes that went out about 6 feet each, if I remember correctly. And in each pipe, in one pipe, he put a vacuum. In the other, he put gases. And there were windows between the pipe to contain either the gas or the vacuum. And then at the far end of this 6 foot reach, he had this little apparatus that when it warmed up, it would do something electrical. And so you had a needle that would show, okay, this side is getting warmer than this side, or this side is warmer than the other side. And being a Victorian scientist, he put in one of his tubes a mixture of oxygen and nitrogen because, you know, it's about 28% oxygen and 70% nitrogen in the atmosphere. Therefore, we're going to measure 30% oxygen, 70% nitrogen, and we'll see what the heat retention properties are. And the results? Zero. It turns out that oxygen and nitrogen are just as transparent to the infrared part of the spectrum as they are to the part of the spectrum our eyeballs can pick up. That was it. Then he measured all the other gases, and of course, carbon dioxide, even though it had very small concentration, it shot through the roof. And it's stable, and from there on, other people did other experiments, and we have climate change science.
For those interested in reading more, Tyndall is spelled T-Y-N-D-A-L-L.
That's right. Yeah. And just like with the Miller experiment, his original apparatus is still around. I believe it's in the Tyndall Center somewhere in Scotland, maybe London.
The super condensed version that, you know, the synopsis that Google will provide if you search for John Tyndall greenhouse gas is, in 1859, Tyndall showed that gases, including carbon dioxide and water vapor, can absorb heat. His heat source was not the sun, but radiation from a copper cube containing boiling water. In modern terms, this was infrared radiation, just like that emanating from the Earth's surface. What I find really, what leaps out at me is the, in modern terms, this was infrared radiation. There was no such concept 150 years ago.
I think there was.
Oh, really?
I think there was. The original experiment to detect it was outlined but never executed by a woman named Duchatelet, Emily Duchatelet, who was the boyfriend of Voltaire, and they were both big science geeks. But Voltaire was hogging all of the thermometers, and so she couldn't do any experiments. She outlined an experiment that 80 years later was executed by, I don't remember his name. A man accidentally put a prism up there, and he shone the sun through the prism, and he had various thermometers. And as the sun moved, he realized that the thermometer next to the red part of the prism at the very top of the prismatic scale was getting warm, even though there was no light on it. That's where he coined the term infrared, which would have been 80 years, maybe 10 or 15 years before Tyndall.
Well, I'm looking at, I'm cheating, of course, because I'm Googling as you're talking.
Of course, of course.
You're thinking of Sir William Herschel.
Okay.
And according to Google, he discovered infrared radiation in 1800.
Okay.
I don't know when the term infrared radiation came into effect. Like, I don't know who discovered the concept of radiation, you know, but yes, Tyndall did do that experiment in 1800. So over 200 years ago.
No, Herschel did it.
Herschel, right.
Yes.
Sir William Herschel.
Okay.
Yeah, not Tyndall.
Yeah. Emily Duchatelet, one of the unsung heroes. She was the first person to translate Newton's Principia into French from Latin. And that's one of the reasons. And one of the reasons that the French got a jump on physics was that she also translated, who's the German guy who came up with physics at the same time as Newton?
Was it Mach? I'm just throwing out random names of German scientists from history. But,
little Mozart, little Bach. I call it a Mach.
No, Mach, as in like Mach 1, Mach 2.
No. A more recognizable name from history.
Let's see.
I don't remember. Anyway, he was contemporaneous with Leibniz.
Okay.
Leibniz. Boy, Newton was pissed because Leibniz first published. Otherwise, if Leibniz hadn't published first in calculus, we would be calling them fluxions. That was Newton's term.
You know, I'm most familiar with Leibniz from philosophy.
Yes.
But until about 10 minutes ago, there wasn't much distinction to be made between the natural sciences and philosophy.
Exactly. Yes. Yeah. The same with Descartes. You know, we have the Cartesian grid and we have algebra thanks to Descartes. We also have cogito ergo sum,
Yep.
Which is all I remember.
So the unnamed gentleman that I had lunch with just before I left Texas, and I may be able to get him on the podcast in the future, but until such time, he'll just have to remain anonymous. But he's done a lot of work, with the defense industry at high levels. So he's quite adept at scientific topics. But, you know, climate change is not his bailiwick. He's very, I wouldn't say contemptuous, but he's unimpressed by the science marshaled, at least in the popular discourse around climate change. And, you know, he talks about how increasing CO2 in the atmosphere could lead to global cooling. It all depends on, you know, the specifics of cloud formation. If the air is warmer above the ocean, that's going to increase ocean water evaporation, which is going to increase cloud cover. And, you know, white fluffy clouds reflect sunlight. So ultimately, heating the atmosphere could reduce the amount of solar radiation reaching the Earth.
Okay.
And, you know, so when people start talking to him about CO2 concentrations, he asks them about their theory of cloud formation, and they sputter. They're like, what? Cloud formation? I don't study that. I study CO2 concentrations.
Right. Yeah, Peter Ward had a section in his book, I believe, called Under a Green Sky, where he addressed that very issue. And
well, he had a whole book called Under a Green Sky.
Yes, but he had a portion that dealt with cloud formation and what happens when we lose the poles, that we may not have clouds nearly in an abundance because we won't have wind, things like that. Yeah, because it takes the thermal difference between the hot parts and the cold parts of the planet in order to make the winds and the weather. So we're in a certain in a certain context, according to Ward, our climate might get really boring. Like less rain, more sun, or more rain, less sun, depending on where you are, of course. Don't remember everything about that section, but yeah.
You know, one of the brilliant aspects, from a completely amoral standpoint, a brilliant aspect of Christianity is the fact that it identified lustful feelings, even lust, you know, in pubescent boys who are not lusting, they might be lusting after a teddy bear, you know, they're always turned on sexually. Just associating that feeling with sin. Such that everybody is sinful all the time just for being human. That, you know, you can't escape your sinful nature by being a good person in this framework. The only remedy for your awful sinfulness is to accept, you know, the grace of Jesus Christ and accept salvation. But there's nothing you can do to make yourself not horrible. Well, the climate change, the mainstream climate change guilt-inducing, you know, apparatus does something very similar. It identifies just the things that everybody does to live. You know, you flick a switch and the lights come on. You're killing the planet when you flip that switch. But none of us built this world that, you know, we were born into. It's not within our power to not need to be able to see. You know, it's not within our power to not be able to not need to move around. And it's just not practical, you know, in a world built with cars and airplanes and trains and buses in mind, to ride a horse everywhere.
Right.
You know, it's not an option. You go to Walmart and there's not a place to tie up your horse. You know,
unless you're an Amish country, then
yes. I have seen many an Amish buggy tied up at Walmart, but I've also been in Walmart when somebody came over the PA and said, whoever owns such and such buggy, you know, your horse is loose, go get it.
Yeah. You don't have that problem with a Pinto. Well, I guess if your horse was a Pinto, never mind. That's a bad comparison. I always go back to the worst car I've ever driven, and there you go.
You know, when I got hit by a car on foot at age 11, I guess it was a Pinto that hit me.
Hopefully it didn't back into you. You'd been engulfed in flames.
No. He hit me on the highway. He was going about 35 miles an hour.
Wow.
Yeah,
oh,
fortunately,
dear.
I went over the top of the car rather than being thrown to the pavement.
Yeah, absolutely. What you say is absolutely correct. I mean, let's look through the patent information. And one of the earliest patents was somebody named, I believe it was William Savory, who patented the engine to raise water by fire in 1699. It was designed to be a device that drained water out of coal mines so you can get more coal.
Yep.
And from there you have Thomas Newcomen in his pump, and then you have James Watt, who discovered the flaw in Thomas Newcomen's pump. And from Watt, things really took off. You know, then 1829 was the first practical locomotive. This guy named Stevenson built the Rocket. So 1829 is almost 200 years ago. This has been going on for a very long time.
You know, it makes me wonder what the word rocket meant at that time.
I think there were rocets. They weren't tactical, aimable, but I think the concept of loading gunpowder into a tube has been around for a very long time.
Right. Okay. So fireworks, basically.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. I mean, come on. It's the bullet, the rocket. There are some cool names that you can use for a fast vehicle. Let's face it.
Yeah. But the word bullet meant something else before firearms.
That would make sense. They just appropriated.
Right.
Well, it was the ball before then because of the musket. What was the bullet requires the barrel to be rifled.
Well, I think that if you were to hurl a metal object with a sling, it was called a bullet.
Ah, okay.
I'm just reproducing from memory. I'm going to look it up.
That's I'm just, while you're looking up, I'm looking over to the comments. And Jesse has a good question. He says, a tiny percent of people are able to understand and appreciate the nuance and uncertainty in science research, but doing so seems a requirement to make big policy decisions. Yeah, that's very true. The number of times I've read histories of laws being passed and you have a bunch of senators and representatives who do not understand the problem, there are a lot of those. So, does technocracy solve this?
Well, we'd have to define technocracy.
Yes.
And I'm going to click away from the Wikipedia entry on bullets. getting deep into the weeds very quickly. Let's see. So technocracy, basically rule by technocrats, which is to say rule by people who are specialists in technical fields.
I would say, in my opinion, technocracy still must bend to democracy. To have a bunch of people who say, I get to be heard because I have this, is kind of like saying, for a king to say, I get to be heard because daddy was king before me.
Yeah, technocracy, it tends to lead to credentialism.
Yes.
And credentialism is not necessarily the single root, but it is a root of much of our current troubles.
Yes.
In terms of people not being able to get jobs that will support a middle-class lifestyle without a certificate from some accredited university saying, yes, this person has spent the required time in the seat, in the class, listening to the right people.
Yes, without the people who currently comprise what we would call a technocracy, I'm doubtful that we would have had such sectarianism that we have today.
So I think it's Kotkin. Is it Peter Kotkin who wrote...
Joel Kotkin.
Joel Kotkin. He wrote The Coming of Neo-Feudalism, right?
I have not read that one. I want to. I believe it was... there's a wait at the library.
Let's see. Kotkin.
He does other things.
Yeah. You know.
He mouths off into microphones.
Coming of Neo-Feudalism. That's Joel Kotkin, right. So in it, he's talking a lot about technocracy.
Yeah.
And one of the... recognizable, repeatable aspects of technocracy is that it tends to be, technocrats tend to be very, very narrow in their focus. You know, their education is very specific, but they tend to assume that everything that is important in the world falls within their very narrow purview, and
yes,
everything outside of it is just gobbledygook.
Yes, they are very good with a hammer, but you get them a screwdriver, and they're like, what?
So, the point that Kotkin was making was that technocrats are certainly necessary when living in a complex technological society like the one that we live in, but they should never be at the top of the pecking order. Technocrats should report to a wise generalist who will take their information on board but make common sense-based decisions.
Yes, and one of the big complaints that I have with the meritocratic elite today is this insistence on the scientificity and the scientism in making it sound unimpeachable, even though it's unintelligible. They need to be able to speak to people who don't have their expertise. I mean, there are people that do that. I mean, Bill Nye, Neil deGrasse Tyson, I think do that very well. But the number of people who can barely, you know, order dinner coherently but still have PhDs up the wazoo is shocking.
Right. And a fair number of those people, I'm not saying most, but I've encountered a fair number of them, who express contempt for the notion of small talk. Like if you're not talking about weighty subjects using very precise language, then you're just wasting air. You know, they're talking to somebody about the weather or a sports match or politics or anything like that. You know, any of the coffee table or cocktail party talk that people engage in, you know, just to build relationships with one another, that's all a waste of time. And the folks who insist on this are typically focusing far away from their own social deficits.
Yes. Yes. Edward Casimir. I hope I get your name right there, sir.
Has a good, we call him.
Ed Willing. Ed, very good. In other words, liberal arts majors should have more power than STEM graduates. I'm assuming that's a question mark, because I wouldn't say more power. I would say they need to be able to get along with STEM graduates in order to convey the STEM graduate message well.
Yeah, you need a talented generalist who can take on board information from specialists and be able to speak their language if they can't speak his.
Yes.
Making policy decisions.
Yeah, one of the biggest deficits, I think, in all of history was the fact that Keynes and FDR did not understand each other.
So I have been ignoring the chat, and I do apologize for that. I'm scrolling back to something that looks familiar. Okay, here we are. So you've picked up some of these. I see Jesse has pointed something, has posted. He says, a tiny percentage of people are able to understand and appreciate the nuance and uncertainty in science research, but doing so seems a requirement to make big policy decisions. Does technocracy solve this? So that's the one we've been asking or answering. Mm-hmm. And I think we've answered that one fairly thoroughly, but I'm going to recap it anyway. Does technocracy solve this? No, technocracy exacerbates a lot of the problems that we're struggling with right now. Technocrats need to be answerable to generalists. Jake says, any opinion on Ben Davidson, Micro Nova / Suspicious Observers dude? I am completely unfamiliar with Ben Davidson and the Micro Nova / Suspicious Observers dude. Do you know anything about that?
It probably isn't Harley's brother.
What Harley Davidson two last names?
That's a joke. Yes, I understand. Please, no death threats. I'm not going to go, oh, Harley, that's one of them Japanese motorcycles. I won't be saying that. Don't worry about it. Okay. I'm unfamiliar with Jake. Sorry.
We create our story posts two emojis, and I don't know what they are. They're just too small.
Yeah, they are tiny on our screen. I see one is made of mostly white and the other mostly green. That's a small emoji, yeah. And Ed Willing says, it's good to see these guys getting along so with each other so well. Who are we talking about?
You and me?
Oh, okay.
I don't know.
All right, yeah, that's cool.
Are we coming from opposite sides of some big divide? If we are, I'm not aware of it.
I never gave it a lot of thought. I mean, we have not spent enough time consuming adult beverages to know that your beer sucks and mine is still great, you know.
Yes.
Or something like that.
You know? We do need to fix that.
I'm
willing to travel to Seattle, you know, to fix that. You've got
I've got a liquor cabinet with uncracked single malts ready for you.
Oh, I think we should start with the beer though.
Of course, but
locally crafted.
There's a lot of that. There always is. Oh, okay.
Yes, Ed says that the word bullet does come from a French word with a similar sound, which, you know, if I were to try to read it, it would just be me saying bullet with a dumb French accent, so I won't.
It's not boulet. That's a joke.
It's actually B-O-U-L-E-T-T-E.
Yeah, I'm reading it. And, yeah. I know with one T, they just go A. And yeah. Right. Please, no French hate mail, please.
So the chamber has to be stronger than the explosion. I think that's from the bullet conversation. Very much technocratic policies tend to be good, but it does not win hearts and minds at all. Yeah, I think that technocracy leads to bad policy in general, just because of the narrow focus of most technocrats or technical people.
Well, there's also what people view as the threat from technocracy to a traditional lifestyle, which is the turnkey and live crowd. Yeah. You know, in this case,
spell out what that means, turnkey and live.
Well, we talked about it earlier in the episode. It was people who get in their car and they drive there, and then they go in their car and drive there. So they have three places basically that they drive: the store, the work, the home, and the occasional other things that they do, the road trip.
And the church in parts of the country.
And how's that?
The part of the country where I live, the church is
also a place where they drive. We have that as well. Absolutely. In fact, I'll probably be doing quite a bit more driving to church in the near future because my mother's driving ability is starting up to decline. That's an aside. She's fine. But yeah, exactly. Yes. And the church, of course, is a stable source, if it is not heretical, of cultural mores. And we have a church with a parking lot. That is not a problem to people who have the turnkey and live. Now, if you have people saying that the car is the problem, well, now we have to redesign our entire life, not just what we do, but the buildings within. Because let's face it, in most communities where you have parking lots, you can't easily walk to church from home. So, yeah, it does not win hearts and minds at all. Absolutely. When they see their way of life going away, if these climate change technocrats take over, you have a huge butting of heads and gnashing of teeth.
So I don't know if I would, this is probably unproductive. Speaking of technocrats, does Anthony Fauci count as a technocrat?
I am hesitant to dip a toe in those waters.
I fully understand.
I have been listening to, I hate to say both. Okay, let me give you some background. And for people who've heard my cast, it's already there. But this is where I'm coming from. I have a union job, and I am what they call a shop steward. A shop steward is somebody who deliberately reads all the policies without falling asleep so that when somebody has a problem, when they are in trouble with management, when they get complaints, when there are videos showing them doing horrible things, I am the one who advises them, kind of like legal defense, kind of, except I'm not a lawyer. Full disclosure, I'm not a lawyer. That said, I know hopefully a little more than they do, and I'm able to help them. Now, because the state of Washington adopted the emergency proclamation along with the rest of the country back in, was it March 2020? Was that correct? And because the state of Washington then looked at the amount of vaccinations in the general populace, and I believe the technical term is shit themselves, they decided that they were going to say, you cannot be employed if you don't get vaccinated. And so I had a great number of people coming up to me and giving me their reasons for not getting vaccinated. And some of them, I'm not judging, but of course, because I'm human, I'm judging. When anyone says I'm not judging, they're judging. It's just rule of thumb. But I'm able to keep a straight face, and I'm able to listen and compassionately listen. That's where you listen well enough that you can repeat their position back to them with different words.
Yes.
If you can't do that,
you understand, right?
Exactly. You have to understand where they're coming from before you can even render an opinion. And if you can't do that, you're not listening. Okay. Word of mouth. Rule of thumb. That's what I meant. Okay. So after I read that, after I heard my coworkers, and many of whom have moved on through what they call a non-disciplinary separation, I looked into it, and wow, there is more to the Fauci story than is being talked about on the general approved, non-censored areas. I'll just leave it at that.
Okay. Is this going back to the 80s, late 80s, and the AIDS epidemic and Fauci's role in that?
I heard a bit about that. I didn't focus on it because I really wasn't interested. No, this is all more recent.
Oh, okay. Yeah, so I am not averse to the deep, what's the word I'm looking for, conspiratorial regions, but I'm not going to venture into them today on this call because we're going to wrap it up pretty soon.
Right. And also, we are living in a technocracy, and if you're going to host it on a certain site, the technocracy will be listening, and it may not stay up.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, I am streaming this to YouTube, which is why we have commenters. So Ed says, Demos must prevail over technos.
Yeah.
What does that mean?
Well, the people, the demos, must prevail over the technocracy. Now, I don't think the demos should prevail over the physics and the technology.
Right. We're not going on the speed of light. Exactly.
That's right. We're not going to try to outlaw carbon dioxide. We're not going to try to legislate against farts. Right. Yes.
It continues. I prefer a benevolent AI to allocate resources than a competitive human passion driven capitalist economic system. Well, the benevolent AI at this point is science fiction and possibly Pollyanna science fiction.
I would just say I'm human and I'm going to stay that way. And
I'm rooting for Team Human.
Team Human. Sorry.
I kind of take Demos Must Prevail Over Technos to be antithetical to I prefer a benevolent AI to allocate resources. That seems to be very different statements.
Yeah, that's why I think there's a real... We have to play together in the yard, the Demos and the Technos.
And then he says, in other words, liberal arts majors should have more power than STEM graduates. I disagree with that. I think that a lot of the authoritarianism coming from the left right now was spawned in the liberal arts departments of college campuses.
Oh, I'm gonna chime in here and say there's a lot of totalitarian tendencies in the STEM field as well.
There's certainly a lot of libertarian sentiment in Silicon Valley in the information field. You know,
That's what I said. Just I use different words. That's all. Libertarian, fascism, same.
So Dryland Fish addresses this question to Ed, but he asks if he's read Marshall Brain's Mana. Mm. And I would say to everybody, Mana is a book that you can read in one sitting quite easily. It's very short, and it's worth reading. It's about the automation of everyday life, you know, everyday jobs, and the different societal approaches to technological unemployment.
It's a way of saying if you haven't gotten a job with a union, find one. my particular position, we have cameras everywhere now because cameras are cheap and memory is cheap. And it's a good way, I have to say, of knowing what happened as opposed to the he said, she said. I will say, though, because I have a fairly strong union, none of those cameras are pointed at me.
All right.
That is in the contract. I cannot get in trouble for that stuff because the camera is on the people outside the bus and inside the bus, not on me.
Okay, and I'm going to stop there because thereafter, Jim starts saying, and now you're silent, even though I was still talking. And then soon after, Jim, you know, he fell off the call and it just got messy. So we're going to cut it off there. And I'm going to jump back to this notion of scientificity. This is something that Jim brought up, and he referenced Thomas Piketty. And scientificity is basically just, you know, it is the quality of being scientific. And this is something that people in the softer sciences strive to, you know, cultivate the appearance of scientificity. And this is related to a concept that I'm more familiar with, or a phrase I'm more familiar with, which is physics envy. So, quoting Google here, economists are often accused of having physics envy. They want to be like physicists. They want their field to be mathematical, rigorous, scientific, and objective. They want to model human behavior as if it were a particle. The phrase is intended as a criticism. And now I'm going to read to you just a little bit, just a very, very little bit, from The Beginning of Capital in the 21st Century by Thomas Piketty. Quote, to put it bluntly, the discipline of economics has yet to get over its childish passion for mathematics and for purely theoretical and often highly ideological speculation, at the expense of historical research and collaboration with the other social scientists. Economists are all too often preoccupied with petty mathematical problems of interest only to themselves. This obsession with mathematics is an easy way of acquiring the appearance of scientificity, without having to answer the far more complex questions posed by the world we live in. This is one great advantage of being an academic economist in France. Here, economists are not highly respected in the academic and intellectual world, or by political and financial elites. Hence, they must set aside their contempt for other disciplines and their absurd claim to greater scientific legitimacy, despite the fact that they know almost nothing about anything. Close quote. All right, well, I'm going to leave it there. That is all for this episode of the CROM Vault podcast. I will talk to you again soon. Thank you for listening. Thank you for subscribing. Stay well.